done right now.
Just wanted to remind you before we get started, because I don't remember what I said.
Okay, yes, it is recording now.
Yeah, I see it now. Okay, I see it.
So tell us your name and your class.
Okay, well, my name is officially Margaret Hodgkin Lippert. However, I renamed myself in college. So I'm now Meg to everybody. Nobody calls me Margaret anymore, thank goodness.
What made you rename yourself?
Well, I was called Margaret as a little child. And then when I got to high school, which was okay. I mean, you know, you had no choice as a little child. At least I didn't feel like I did. And then when I got to high school, my hockey teammates called me Marge, which I just hated. I just thought like that was just like a muddy, horrible, sloshy name. And I needed a new name. So I read this book called, not Little Women, I named myself after a character in this book about a Scottish girl named Maggie. So I thought, well, Meg is a good name, I'll be Meg. Cause I could always, I know Meg was a nickname for Margaret. So, and ever since that, and then I when I went to college, so I wrote all my like labels on my shampoo bottles and everything, I wrote Meg Hodgkin on all of them. And I like transformed myself. And so my dad had trouble getting used to it. My mom pretty much always had trouble getting used to it. But then I noticed she died when I was a sophomore, and I found some pictures later on that she had written the names on the backs of, because she knew she was dying. So she was trying to identify everybody on the backs of all these family pictures before she died. And I noticed that she had written my name, Meg, on the back of a picture, but she had put Meg in quotation marks. So I always love telling that story to my class, because I used to teach storytelling, and my first class was on names and what people felt about their names. And we went around and I learned their names that way. And so I always told them that story because I always loved the fact that my mom had managed to call me Meg, but she still didn't think of it as my name.
And so your class of 1962, your class of 64, and you started in 1960.
Right.
Tell us how you got there. What made you come to Swarthmore?
Swarthmore is not my first choice.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, we were allowed to apply to 5 colleges in our high school. I went to a public high school. Mm-hmm. So my parents told me when I was a junior high school, entering junior high school, they said that I could either go to a public high school and a private college, or I could go to a private high school and a public college, but they couldn't afford to pay for both. And we lived next to George School, very close to George School, only a few miles from George School. I don't know if you know that school.
Yes, yes.
And most of the people in the community where I grew up, which was an intentional Quaker founded community, went to George School. And they have like a whole cohort of people who went there, but I didn't get to go there. And I told my parents when I was in 7th grade that I would choose to go to a public high school and a private college in case I wanted the option when I graduated as a senior to go to a private college. And so that's why I had the opportunity to go to Swarthmore. And my first choice was Wellesley because my cousin went there and I was very insecure. And you know, I thought that having her there, she was a few years older than me, would help me. And I got put on the waiting list. Mm-hmm. And then I got accepted at Swarthmore and I thought, well, it was closer to home. My mom was very ill. And that's kind of, and I felt comfortable because it was Quaker. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In heritage and tradition. And I'm a birthright Quaker from a long, long, long Quaker heritage on both sides of my family. And so that was a factor for me.
Once you got there, your writings indicate that you are very active in many of the foundational Quaker activities, ideas, philosophies. You did the work camps and you did the volunteer work. You really worked to make people's lives better. So I wonder, when you stepped foot on campus, did you feel at home there, like you were continuing sort of in the way you were brought up as a Quaker? Did you feel that your activism was a continuation or natural outgrowth maybe of your Quaker religion?
I wasn't at all conscious of anything like that at the time. But now that you're asking me these questions, it was just like part of like breathing to me. I didn't like make any kind of connection of this is my heritage or anything. It was just like, well, of course I was going to go tutor in Chester. I mean, it was like, I really never decided.
That is an oddly strange and completely uniform through line from all of the former students to whom I have spoken. Everyone says that it was never intentional, or it was just the thing to do, the next natural activity for you at this stage is exactly what you did. I wonder why, if you have any further ideas or thoughts about why it seems so natural to go in the direction of activism or community aid or into communities like your writings about going into Tennessee, that you may never have thought about before.
I lost track of the question, actually.
I'm wondering if you thought that your activism after you got to Swarthmore was like the next most natural thing for you to do.
Right. No, I didn't think that. And the reason why, now that I think about it for the first time, is that the culture of my family, my parents were extremely courageous. They met when they were in college. My mom went to the University of Maine. And my dad went to King's College, Cambridge. They met in the summer at Pendle Hill up in South China, Maine, where my dad's dad, okay, I have to back up a little bit. I feel like I'm kind of like sidetracking your question.
Let's carry on.
But my dad's father was the first director of Pendle Hill. Do you know what Pendle Hill is?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, tell our audience, I know, but the audience may not know. So tell them.
Okay, Pendle Hill is a Quaker Center for, it was called the Quaker Center for Study and Contemplation, and it's in Wallingford, Pennsylvania. Right. And it turns out to be right across the Crum Creek from Swarthmore College, mm-hmm. which I was not aware of intellectually, but I really feel like I was led. And the way I think of it is like by the hand of God, actually, to be planted at Swarthmore College, where I could access Pendle Hill as a spiritual and social and emotionally nurturing community when I was lost in every way. I mean, my family was torn apart by the illness and death of my mom when I was a sophomore on Christmas Day. And even before that, with her surgeries or breast cancer, I had taken care of her in high school. I had taken her for radiation treatments. I was responsible for holding my family together. I was exhausted. And I arrived at college like completely overwhelmed with the intellectual demands of the school. I'm feeling completely, I had no idea how to study. I memorized everything in high school, so I'd gotten straight A's. I didn't really have any idea how to think. My professors would meet with me like independently to try to help me, like, you don't have to write everything down. You don't have to memorize everything. You just basically process it. I mean, I just didn't have, I hadn't have any idea that how to learn. My dad had always told me how stupid I was, berated me for like making a single tiny mistake on a math test. And there was a lot of abuse in my family, which was all hidden because it's all like a Quaker family, you know? So, and then, so anyway, my parents met, they got married, they communicated for a year by letter, they got married, they moved to Philadelphia, which was the center of Quakerism at that time, or a big center of Quakerism. And my mom, however, although she came from a Quaker heritage in Maine, she was actually a cousin of Rufus Jones. Her mom was Jones. And Rufus Jones is an American Quaker who is, who taught at Haverford, and he was a wonderful man. I knew him until he died when I was six, just before my brother died. And I mean, I still feel that his warmth and love of me, and everybody feels this way, all of my cousins who knew him, who grew up with me, you know, I was telling a story about him one time and I said, like, I was his special little girl. And my cousin said, no, I was his special little girl. And then we realized like everybody was his special little girl. Oh, well, you know, that's why he was who he was, so beloved. And so, you know, I had this like heritage in my family, my grandfather on one side who started Pendleville, who was really a loving man. And my cousin Rufus Jones, who was also gave me before I was six, an awareness of my importance. And I had a brother, David, who was, I was 4 years older than me, who also gave me that awareness, who died when he was 10 and tore our family apart. So, I mean, his death did, his loss. And so, you know, as I kind of process this a little bit with you, it seems obvious to me that there's no way I could have come out of this as a healed human being when my parents were suffering and that got no help. But what helped, what shaped me was the community where I grew up, because my parents were one of the first 10 families to start this cooperative, intentional community outside Philadelphia. They got together with a group of 9 other families with young children. And in 1940, they met every single week for a year to plan this intentional community. And they called it Bryn Gwelyd Homesteads, which happened to be my dad's name, which means hill of vision. And in Welsh, because it's in an area where Welsh settlers were in Bucks County. And it's this beautiful farmland. They bought these two old farms, and this 10 families like engineered roads protecting the common land, divided into 70 lots because they thought we're going to have 70 families live here eventually. And it still survives today, this community. And we're having a reunion again this summer. Those of us who grew up there, we're just all so rooted and attached in this community. So, I mean, I helped build our house. You know, we couldn't move there until David died because he needed so much medical care. But we did move there that summer after he died. So I went, and that's when we, but what happened in this community was that in spite of the fact that my family was so dysfunctional, I had like, I wrote a story once called 53 Mothers, because I thought, and then there's another piece of it that I wrote that called 4 Mothers that I shared with one of our reunions. It's, and I can share that with you. It's just a story about being cared for by our community, and the land was so important to us. I mean, we just roamed all over the land as kids. Nobody ever knew where we were, but we had packs of kids, and it was just like, you know, I mean, there were problems with packs of kids, as you can imagine, but in general, we had this freedom and we had this attachment to the land. So I feel like I was healed by the community and the land, which gave me enough to survive.
Quite well, I might imagine, because you took what is obviously a very painful beginning and transformed that and made a connection. I wonder if you see in reading all of your content, your reminiscences about being with the families, being living on the floor with the sharecroppers and the corn 2 inches outside the door, and working from morning to night, and you know, this blistering, beating down heat. To me, I see a connection between that experience and you know, the love of land that you were raised in. Do you see that? Do you think that helped helped you adapt to the new environment you're going to find yourself in Tennessee?
Well, one thing was that I was very comfortable with African Americans because the family lived across the street from me was African American. And she became my second mother, basically. I babysat for her children. And she's the person, she's one of the four mothers in this story that I will share with you that, that who took care of me, who believed in me, and who loved me. So I had that deep sense of attachment and comfort with, and I think that really helped me to be completely open in a spiritual way mm-hmm. with the experience there and feel completely comfortable, like packed in as the only white person with bodies in a church and being, you know, shot at from outside the church and realizing like I'm safe here, feeling really safe. And there was another place where I went to a little church way, way out in a farm. And there was a very few times when I actually felt safe there because it was very, very scary almost all the time. I felt very vulnerable. I had a car with out of state plates, you know, I was repeatedly like chased out of the county when I was driving. I had to go across the county line before they would turn around. I would drive like 80 miles an hour sometimes to get away from this, you know, the white CCC people who would just like tail me until just trying to scare me basically. But they actually did run our the guy we were staying with off the road and blamed him, and then he got put in jail. That's what basically started the ball rolling to having to leave that. So it was just basically. But it was also very scary because they did actually shoot at us, but they didn't hit us. But still, it was very like scary. But I remember going down there and feeling like on the way down there, driving down, I remember thinking, it's okay if I die down there.
Wow.
Because I will have died for something I really believe in. And I really didn't care at that point if I lived or died. I really had I didn't feel like I had any future. I couldn't see really, I was just kind of moving through my life because my stepmother had told me I couldn't go home. Mm-hmm. It was her home now. And that's why I went to Tennessee that summer because I had no place to go. So I thought, well, you know, at least somebody will know I'm gone and maybe it will make a difference to somebody. That's what I thought. So I had I had a lot of fear, but it didn't scare me.
So whereas some other people amongst your classmates met very powerful voices of the period, or they had parental influence from a different set of philosophies than you. It sounds like you are one amongst your classmates who found a family in the midst of your activism. There are a few other people who created these incredibly strong bonds with their, just like friends right. and family now. In the struggle, in the movement, but more like brothers almost, more than just we're coming to help and you're happy with our help. So talk more about that.
Yeah, well, that was, I don't know, for me specifically, I mean, I was looking for a home. That's why I initially wanted to move in with Mr. and Mrs. Harris. And right. They wanted me because I was their only, they didn't have any children. So when I came down there and I lived at their farm, way back on this road, and I got waked up by the rooster, I just felt like I was in paradise. I mean, I was so, so happy. And it was like somebody wants me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a home. I mean, I was just like so elated. And that's why after that end of that week of spring vacation, then I asked Mr. Harris, you know, could I work for you this summer in construction? I mean, I knew about building houses. I built my house. We built a lot of houses on Ring Valley, you know. I mean, that was nothing to me. I had pictures of myself as a little child digging the ditches for the foundations for our house, you know. So, I mean, that was natural. And we'd been working on this. And so he said, sure, you know, yeah, he could use another worker. I just live with him and, you know, whatever. He'd pay me something, whatever. So that was the plan. And then I got this letter from him, you know, saying it wouldn't work out. But there was this other Quaker family, and would they take me? And then, so when I got down there, I asked them, would they pick me or when I mail, I forget whether I contacted them first or what happened. It was all very chaotic. And then they said, yeah, if you take care of our little children 2 days a week in exchange, you know, while we're doing the work, then you can stay here. But I really didn't go down there initially to work on civil rights. I went down there because I needed a place to go. And I really loved the South. I loved that feeling of being able to be doing something for a community and you know, so basically what I'd done, you know, worked on the farm. The farmer across the street had this huge zucchini fields, summer squash and tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And of course they needed labor to pick these things. And so basically what they realized was like, you know, I was a picker and work with them all day long in the fields. And at night we'd sort all the vegetables under this big spotlight on their driveway. This dirt driveway. And then in the morning, they would drive them to Memphis. So then I said, you know, I could learn to drive your truck. I could drive it to Memphis. So they're like, great. You know, and then we don't have to drive back and forth all to Memphis every other day, sell these tomatoes or whatever. We sold tomatoes and zucchini. So we'd sort them and package them. And in the morning, I would get up really, really early because the earlier you got there, the better chance there was that nobody else had gotten there first. And if they bought too many, then you had to go around a bunch of stores. And, you know, but there were some people in the stores who wouldn't buy from me because I was white.
Wow, really?
Because they felt like, why, you know, you shouldn't be there. You shouldn't be driving this truck for these Black people. You should be more appropriate to your white skinnishness. So, you know, so I had to pick the stores that would buy for me. And then I had to just drive around until I sold everything in the back of the truck. And then, but that family, that Black family was a family who I was their family, really, because we were all out there working in the field. And it was like, sorting and driving and whatever needed to be done. You know, I was just like their teenage child. So that was one family. And then the family that lived next door to us, and this sharecropper's cabin that we lived in was next door to a farmhouse that had been, actually had a Black family living in that. I don't know how that all happened. But so that family also, they had a girl and a woman. There was a widow there basically. And so that family too, we were very close to. And then also as I worked there, of course, we met other people in the neighborhood, and then there were times when there were people, families who were being shot at by people at night. They would shoot through the windows of these homes that were beside the street. And so, a couple of times I went to their houses and I just to keep them company, and we would just sleep on the floor underneath where the windowsills were.
Mm-hmm.
So. Just to kind of like be a presence there. And it was never clear that we actually were going to survive, but they just shot through the windows. They didn't approach and they just drove by, that kind of thing. So it was scary, but I felt safe.
So how did you get from what seems like very much a neighborhood friendly kind of situation to trying to advocate more directly for civil rights action in this area, in these areas? How did you make that transition?
Well, that was kind of natural because the people I was living with, Art and Carol and Emery, had gone down there to help with voter registration. Mm-hmm. And that's what they were doing. When I was taking care of their kids, they were doing that. So then I kind of moved into that also because like the teenagers in the town were starting to get, the Black teenagers were starting to get interested in civil rights. So there was a movie theater there, they had to sit in the balcony. So they had decided they were going to have a demonstration. And so I joined it. And the night before, I called my dad and I said, I may need bail money because I may get arrested tomorrow.
What did he say?
Well, I realized later on that it was a way of my trying to get him to pay attention to the fact that I was alive, you know, because he was suffering still from my mom, and then he married this horrible woman. And I mean, I thought she was horrible, and it turned out she was horrible. And so he's struggling, and my brother is struggling, and my brother's now in jail because he, instead of registering for the draft, he decided he wasn't going to register, which would put him in jail, which I feel, I told him he should be a conscientious objector because he was a Quaker and he didn't have to go to jail. He could do alternative service, but he had his own issues. And I think he felt like he needed to be punished, which was ridiculous, but he could never live up to my brother, David. He could never be David. He could never fill David's place. And he was always in trouble. And my dad would beat him because he would try to make him not fight. And so that made my brother fight more. And so my brother was just like, oh, so sad. And he just, so my brother reported to me that my dad just went white on the phone. He was there when the phone call came, but my dad never, he just said, okay, keep in touch. And I did get arrested, but the fact of the matter is that the sheriff down there finally realized, like, this is stupid to put a white girl in jail. You know, we're gonna get publicity and stuff from that. So they didn't actually imprison me, although they did, you know, put the kids in jail, the Black kids in jail, but they didn't. They just arrested me. They didn't put me in jail. I keep my phone on because my daughter has an infant and sometimes she's...
It's okay. You have to watch the baby.
I watch the baby a couple of times a week, yeah. So anyway,
you got out of jail and the Black kids stayed.
I didn't go to jail. So, but I, basically what it was is that I was so connected to the community that once, mm-hmm. you know, the kids got involved, of course I was involved because I was more or less their ages. And so that was really good because that's what, it was for that reason that I don't know how I found out that Pete Seeger was singing in Greenwood, Mississippi. But I'd never been across the line to Mississippi. And the thing about that's interesting is that there were two counties in Tennessee at that time, Haywood County and Fayette County, that had a majority of Blacks. So those were the two counties in Tennessee where there was a lot of action. And the reason why Somerville, I don't know if you know this, but the reason why Somerville was so important at that time was because the Black families had started registering to vote. Well, we called them Negroes at that time, but mm-hmm. And so they were being kicked off of their land, out of their sharecroppers. Mm-hmm. And in order to still be able to work down there and live down there, they had formed this tent city. Do you know about that? Okay, so the tent city was partially funded by Quakers. And so Quakers got involved in that. And so that's why this particular area of Tennessee was so primed for action, because already these families had been living in tents, and a lot of them had actually moved back in the community now. They figured out other housing things, but so I wasn't there actually when the tent city itself was on, but the whole network, the whole fabric of the community was like locked in place by having been supported by the Quakers, who had funded, who helped to fund this and had gone down there from Ohio and Indiana, and, you know, more than from the Midwest and from the Philadelphia area.
So may I be clear, just for the audience's sake, are you saying that the families in Somerville were eventually removed from their land, their sharecropping situations, precisely because they attempted to register for the vote?
Yes, yes.
And so just the mere act of registering could have all of your property removed from you.
And your home.
Yes.
Your home, that was the thing. I mean, it wasn't their property in many cases to start with.
Right.
Because they were sharecropping.
But
so they were just, but they had a shack. They had this two bedroom mm-hmm. shack. I'm just going to call it that. Mm-hmm. Two room shack. It was tiny. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, and basically in this one room, there were these space for two double beds, and that was it. Mm-hmm. In this cabin. In the other room, it was just, and it was just like this corrugated iron roof and, you know, walls, and that was it. And this little tiny porch on the front, and this little lean-to in the back where there was a stove, and that was, you know, this one tap. And then, you know, that house, that was it. So it wasn't like their house or anything. It was basically like their dwelling, I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then they had no place to live with their children. So that's why they had this tent city, and that got a lot of press and, you know, mm-hmm. at the time. And so, this made everybody local, like, pissed off, you know, like, we're going to take care of these people, you know, we're just going to, like, scare them to death.
That was the thought, and it didn't work, thank goodness. So tell me about how you crossed that line from Tennessee to Mississippi to see Pete Seeger.
Well, the reason I did that was not so I could see Pete Seeger. It was so the Black kids I had been working with and sitting in with and demonstrating with and being arrested with could hear Pete Seeger. I'd heard Pete Seeger. My first boyfriend at Swarthmore, who I'm still in touch with, and I see him when I'm in Philadelphia, and his wife, took me to Pete Seeger concert, and we sat in the front row. That was our first date, and I was like, whoa, I never really knew anything about Pete Seeger, and I was just like completely blown away. So when I found out that he was going to be singing in Mississippi, I'm like, I'm going to drive down there with the kids. And I packed my car full of kids, Black kids, boys and girls, and down we went. And it was supposed to happen, you know, during the day. So we got down there early. But then there was a newspaper reporter there because Pete Seeger was there, and it was Greenwood, Mississippi. And I didn't even know that at the time. But I subsequently, when I went on a civil rights pilgrimage with some people from the University of Washington, I had the opportunity to several years ago. And we went through Greenwood. And then in doing research for that time I had been there, I found this newspaper article from the New York Times about that concert. I couldn't believe it. So it was wonderful. And it said specifically there was a handful of white people there, and that was me, you know, me with my kids. and the stick workers who lived in Greenwood. Greenwood was a stick, you know, office. This was in Greenwood. Mm-hmm. So there, yeah, so I decided we're going down there, and it was a stupid thing to do because, you know, I'm driving across the state line without a state plate with Black kids in my car. So the minute we crossed the state line, they all got down on the floor. So it just looked like me driving down there. But that was even more suspicious because what's this white person doing in a farm with the out-of-state plate driving through Mississippi? Anyway, we got to Greenwood when it's tiny little dirt road, and I found a place to park on the road. And then it was like, as the newspaper said, you're waiting all day long. It was hotter than hell. It was awful. And so we just waited. And I'm like thinking, oh my goodness, maybe we should go back while it's light, you know, I don't want to drive in the dark. I'm responsible for these kids, but I didn't leave. And it got darker and later, and finally the concert started, and it was like, I mean, I felt so safe there. I mean, of course the police are like back and forth along the road, but they don't dare come into the field. So just scaring us. My car was out there with the license plate. I thought, well, probably got there on it. They may be following me, but. So all day long, yeah, it was beautiful. But singing life was beautiful. And there are pictures of it. This wonderful photographer was down. I don't know if you've seen that article. Have you seen the article in the New York Times?
No.
There are pictures about it. And there was like 10 or 12 pictures of this photographer who was apparently contracted to follow the SNCC workers and took a lot of wonderful, wonderful photographs of Pete Seeger with the SNCC workers and we called him Bobby Dylan, D-I-L-L-O-N. The reporters didn't even know how to spell his name. Bob Dylan was there. And Bob Dylan sang, it was the first time he had ever sung the song he had written about Medgar Evers' assassination. Mm-hmm. And Medgar Evers was killed on my birthday that year, June 1963. And this amazing song about him that he sang. And so, I mean, the whole day just was like, and I mean, to hear like Pete Seeger singing in that context, I just felt completely sick and completely, I mean, I've always loved Pete Seeger, and I took my little kids to see him when he, because we lived in New York. And we got to the library like an hour early because I wanted to be the first ones in the first row so that they could feel what I felt as a teenager. And he sang right there and then. I mean, it was just so wonderful.
So what were some of the reactions of your student friends who are experiencing this show for the first time?
Oh, man, they couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe it. I mean, it was you know, it was really, really special. They were really, really, really excited. They loved the music. They loved Pete Seeger. They loved the fact that everybody was sitting there together. I mean, it's what's not to love? I mean, it's the evening. You know, we've been together all day long. I mean, we hadn't taken much food or water. I don't know how we survived even, but, you know, we're kids. So, and it was fine. And then it breaks up and it's dark. Mm-hmm. That was scary. I found our car, we got everybody packed in, and I started driving back. And then I really like, ooh, this is really stupid. And the thing was, I was really, really tired because I'd gotten up really, really early. I'd been out in the sun all day long, and I fell asleep driving. And I went off the road. And I realized I couldn't get us back. So I said, like, one of the kids said, I know how to drive a tractor. You know, I can drive a car. I can drive a shift. So I'm like, okay. I mean, I really thought I was it. I thought the cops are going to catch us. You'll be driving an out-of-state car. They're going to I lay on the floor at that point in the back. And they sat up because it was okay for them to drive each other. They just couldn't drive a white girl. So whereas they had laid on the floor going down, me driving, I lay on the floor going back, and I went to sleep. And we got back.
God takes care of children.
I know, that's really the way.
Crazy things, and God takes care of them anyway. So that's really quite an exciting college experience, young person experience, teenage experience, you know, just the whole nine yards of all the things you could possibly do at this budding period of the 60s. So since you went into Greenwood and had to wait quite a long time, do you remember anything about the town, the people in it?
I didn't go into Greenwood.
No.
Went straight to the farm.
Okay, it was near, okay.
Never went to Greenwood. Yeah. I mean, I don't even have any memory at all of Greenwood. It had nothing to do with anything. We had to get to the farm, and I don't even know how I knew where it was. I can't remember. I think I have to pat myself on the back because I think like that was pretty cool that I figured out the Pete Seeger is going to be there and I can get there because I have wheels, you know, without knowing anything. But, you know, it never occurred to me that I couldn't find it.
You were guided once again.
I found it. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you tell us, just to switch subjects a bit, you had a long-term tutoring experience in Chester. Can you tell us about that? What made you go there and
oh my God,
experiences?
Again, it was like nourishing myself. I really nourish myself through children.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've always loved children. I mean, it was, and I really think I have a gift for understanding children, and children nourished me. I was nourished by my dolls. Nobody took care of me, but as one of my therapists said, when I asked her, I said, well, how can I ever have children? Nobody, I don't know what mothering is. And she said, no, you knew what you needed as a child. Mm-hmm. And that's what you will give to your own children. And that really helped me to see, like, yes, I didn't know what I needed. I took care of myself. I went to the woods. I found a friend. I found a mothers across the street and another households who loved me. And it wasn't until after long, long after my mom died that I realized that she also was mothering me in her own way, as much as she could in her grief. But as a young child, I needed children. I mean, I babysat for professors when I was there. You know, it was like, I knew enough about myself to know I couldn't be in a, I didn't really get along with my peers. I didn't really have peer friends. I didn't really know how to like navigate this whole social scene. I did have this one wonderful boyfriend who's 10 years older than me, who still to this day, I mean, we just have the bond of loving each other at that point. He was also Quaker, but is also Quaker. But no, I went to Chester because I needed the children. I knew there was an opportunity to be with children, and everybody had always told me I was going to be a teacher, although I was denied it, but of course I was a teacher. And it was, I don't know. One thing I did do though, I remember I used it as healing time for me, because I walked to Chester from Swarthmore, which is a long way. I walked there and I walked back. And I had a little book called Songs of All Time, because I went to a folk dance camp when I was a teenager, and we had singing class as well as dancing classes, folk songs and folk dances. And this little book is full of folk, American folk and English folk songs. And I would just read through the songbook from one to the next, and I would learn all the verses and just sing all the way there and back. That was kind of my time to take care of myself when I was suffering so much at college.
And you were suffering at college because even though you had activist work to do, you were just family and kind of socially disconnected?
And academically. See, I was way, way out of my depth at Swarthmore because I had no training in thinking. And a lot of the kids who went there were really good at it. Like they could read a book and understand what it meant. And I had to read Tom Jones, and I mean, I read like word for word, and by the end of the chapter, I had no idea what was in it. I really didn't know. So I read through the book, and it was like, just like mechanically reading a word and a word and a word. And so, I mean, I actually flunked my senior thesis, but thank God the Dean of Women let me out of there. But you know, I read the Shakespeare plays, but I mean, I went completely over my head. I mean, I got my first semester, I got an A, 3 B's and a C. And that was Christmas vacation was when I met my boyfriend. And so he was really impressed, like I was did so well, you know. But then my mom had her second breast removed that Christmas vacation. And then after that, I just thought, I only got C's the whole rest of, which is flunking basically in Swarthmore. I never got another A or B the whole time I was there. I basically just, I think my professors just saw this pathetic girl and just like, give her a C, you know, because like, I mean, I tried to do the work, but I learned like that much the whole time I was there.
Did you have time to get involved in any of the student organizations that a lot of the activist students were in? Were you in SDS? Did you run into, you know, none of that? No?
I didn't join any student organizations because what I was doing was I was busy commuting to Pendle Hill by foot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Dick, this guy, knew Pendle Hill because he had some friends there. So as soon as I met him, we would go to Quaker meeting there, and sometimes in the living room of the director, who was wonderful, Paul Lacey, and his wife, Margaret Lacey, and their kid. I mean, it just was, it's a haven for me. Pendle Hill, like, cared for me. And there were people there who really loved me, creative people. Mary Carolyn Richards and Paul Berenson, who are pottery teachers and weaving teachers. And I learned to weave there, and I threw pots there. And, you know, they took this poor, poor suffering girl, and they saw in me something special. And it wasn't until years later that I realized, like, in fact, it wasn't until I read that letter that I saw that I'd written about what MC had told me, MC Richards had told me, like, you know, they took me up to their house in New York and climbing their stream and stuff. I mean, they just like kind of like adopted me. Thank God. And so that was really my family during Swarthmore. I've made some wonderful friends there. This woman, Janaki Shanaral, she was from India. I thought she was just like, she was so good to me. But the artists, they, you know, I guess they liked me because they took me everywhere with them. And as you know, it was interesting that MC, that I wrote down that she's giving me this feedback, like I'm special, like, wow, whew. That was good. My professors never did that.
You tutored these students in Chester. And so do you think you passed along any of that constructed family feeling to them? How did they react to the kinds of violence and disruption going on around them? Did they turn to you for, can we talk about this? Mm-hmm.
Did they, what was the last part of your question?
So did they turn to you for someone to kind of talk to you about what's going on around them?
No, they were younger kids, like 4th, 5th, and 6th graders that I worked with, I think. No, I just basically did tutoring strictly.
We hadn't gotten to that stage yet where kids are going to try to talk to you about what's going on or not. You know,
well, they didn't talk to me. Maybe they talked to others of my peers. But I wasn't there for any like political reason. I was just there because they were kids who needed help. And there was a program. So I didn't have to organize it. I just slotted myself into hours and I just went. It was easy. So I did no organization there. I mean, I played cello in my orchestra in high school 4 years. I loved the cello, but I didn't do it at Swarthmore. I was in the chorus at high school. I didn't try out for the chorus. You know, I just felt completely like out of it. I felt completely overwhelmed. I felt like I'm not good at anything. I'm not certainly not playing. I'm not going to sing. I just didn't do anything except survive and attend my classes. It was hard. And the thing was, it was interesting because like my mom had told me, you don't know anybody from the South. This was so interesting about my mom. She said, you've never been to the South, so why don't you sign up for a Southern roommate? You know, you get to know somebody from the South. So I did, because I did what my mother told me to. And I got put with this girl. I won't repeat her name, but she thought I was really, like, trash, because I hadn't come out. I said, what do you mean come out? I had no idea what coming out was.
Oh, yes.
So she came from Tulsa, Oklahoma. She, when did you come out? What was your coming out? Like, I said, what did you come out of what? I had no idea.
I can imagine.
So she got rid of me as fast as she could. So, you know, she had an older sister who was there who had also come out. you know, which I was not impressed. She expected me to be impressed.
I have to chuckle because I'm from Roanoke, Virginia, and I went to Hollins University, which of which you may be familiar.
Yes,
and I did not come out. I instead went to our family. Well, our family has two sororities and one fraternity that they have populated for generations. So I went to the official presentation of one of the sororities. I do remember this. And, you know, the debutante ball is a big deal. Oh my goodness. The cotillion's a big deal. So yes, I can understand how you.
Yeah, she wanted to know what I had worn when I come out and you know, how it was and all this stuff. I'm like,
what are you talking about?
I wasn't impressed. That's what got her upset, I think. That I had no idea what she's talking about. So that just put me like off of the whatever social register she was interested in. So anyway, no, I didn't. So then I found a roommate. So she abandoned me at this, you know, as soon as she could. And then, of course, I needed a roommate. But fortunately, there was a girl from Philadelphia named Luba Shapiro, and she was Jewish, which, you know, I was comfortable with that because we had Jewish people in our community, as well as the first Blacks and the first Asians in that whole region, the first Jews. So, yeah, I knew what Jews were. So I roomed with her for the next year until she got married. So that was good. And then I got singles after that. Well, I had another partner, another roommate. But anyway, yeah, why did I get into that? I forget what your question
trying
was.
Trying to learn what it was like to be a real Southerner since you didn't know any.
Right. So that's why that was my failure trying to get to know Southerners. So I had my own way of learning to know Southerners. Thank you very much, Mom. After she was gone, I figured it all out for myself. I'll just drive down there alone and I'll make my own friends. Thank you very much.
Well, it was necessary. I mean, the whole point of the movement was to learn that we weren't so different from each other, that we had completely aberrant needs and desires. And so, you know, there are many ways to go about that. But you all were those who opened the door to begin the conversation, to begin the sitting next to each other.
And I never thought of it that way. That's the interesting thing, because for me, I wasn't opening any doors because I had grown up in an interracial community.
And that by itself is highly unusual.
There was no interracial housing in Philadelphia anywhere. That's why my parents got together with these people and said, we are going to build interracial housing. And this was always designed as an interracial community, although the first 10 families, there were no Blacks. And it took a lot of courage for that first Black family to move into this white area. And the family that moved across the street from us that was Black, they took their children back every single Sunday back to their neighborhood so they wouldn't forget where they came from. And you know what life was like. Although they did build this, you know, very small, modest little house and became very important parts of our community. But that was their design. And my parents said, it's an intentional community. We are intentionally going to go out and look for interracial, interreligious, you know, whatever mixed couples are there. We had single women live there. Very unusual at that time. The single women have their own house. You know, I mean, that was very radical. So...
Were at this time, were there Blacks in the Quaker church?
No.
When did
I can say that definitively? Because there were no Blacks in our class. You know that. Did you know that?
Oh no, I wasn't talking about it at school, but yes, I did. Now I think the first one was 63.
There was a Black person, but from Africa.
Right. An American.
That was okay. That was okay.
Yes, that's always okay. But
I don't know when the first one was. I don't know when the first one was, but not in our class. So there we were going out, marching, going to Chester, servicing, you know, the Black community, but not what do they say? They say fit for freedom, not for brothers or something like that, not for family, that book about that. Mm-hmm. It's a book about Quakers being, you know, not living what they preach, basically, being hypocritical.
Well, that kind of goes for all religions in some way, yeah. Shape, or form. So,
no, because I know, like 11 o'clock, well, Sunday morning is the most segregated time in the week.
Still to this day. And I have been to many a church. I'm the child of ministers.
You are too. Wow, that's cool.
Yes, it can be. It can be a nightmare. But among my favorite churches, I really, really love the Episcopalian Church and the Unitarian Universalist Church. That might be my favorite. Love it to death.
Yeah, that's interesting because I love the Episcopal Church too. My mom took me there like on Palm Sunday so I could get the palms. And mm-hmm. sometimes she'd take me to the early service and I'd kneel with her. And then she'd say, you can peek, Meg, you can, Margaret, you can peek and see, you know, what they're doing with the palms, because I always loved getting the palms. Yeah, and she was a devoted Episcopalian. So I respect that.
I was a devoted Episcopalian in my 4 years at Holland University, where I sang in the choir and went to church. And when I went back for a reunion, for heaven's sakes, they don't have church every Sunday anymore. And I was just, like, what? You don't have church? I never heard of such a thing. But, you know, times change. And on that note, I have been very interested in a couple of questions from all former students. One being, how you felt and if you were accused of being the quote unquote outside agitator. The more I talk to you all, the more I love to ask this question, because what is being assigned to you is so very different than the types of people you actually are as you speak on this subject. So how did you get that accusation and how did you feel about it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was, because basically we were down there where we didn't belong. You know, this is the way we live. You don't understand our culture. Uh-huh. You know, and you know, I was so, so innocent. Like, I remember thinking, like, I knew the FBI was coming down. The words cut, and they had told us we're coming down. Oh, thank goodness. I can finally report some of the stuff that we're suffering from. I was so excited to meet these guys. Mm-hmm. I couldn't wait to talk to them. And we got in this little office and all of a sudden they started asking me questions about my friends. And I'm like, what? Don't you want to hear about what's happened to me? Like, I've been shot at, you know, I mean, you know, I was working on this roof of Mr. McFerrin's store, and the guys were going by and they're shooting past me. You know, they didn't hit me, but I was working on the back of the roof, but they knew I was there. And so after that, I didn't work on that roof anymore, but don't they want to hear about these people? And I had the license plate numbers and everything. No. The cars outside or the church, and they're firing in the church. They wanted to know about my friends, turns out, of course. I mean, duh. I was like, I couldn't believe it. I was just so disappointed. But then I realized, like, how stupid I was.
Stupid is definitely not the word. New to the process, young, and raised during the period of American history where we had not yet learned en masse to understand how much our leaders lied to us. Right. We still trusted them at that point.
Right.
So you were far from stupid. You just were at the precipice of a terrible door opening that, you know.
Right.
I
still remember like how excited I was and how hopeful and how that came crashing down like in one huge curtain call. It was like, oh my gosh. I just remember sitting there and thinking, oops.
So what did you want to do after that? What, you know, how did it change your thinking? And by the way, did you, like many others, become subsumed in the Vietnam, the anti-Vietnam War fervor. And so that kind of took over the civil rights movement, so to speak.
Well, let's see. Trying to think, I think I was so focused on survival at that point, because I was a junior when I went down there, between my junior and senior years. Mm-hmm. It was before Freedom Summer, you know, and so basically I was obsessed with what am I going to do after I graduate, because I knew I couldn't go home. So I had no place to live, I had no skills. I had nothing. So, but I did have Quakerism. And I did know that one of the people in our community, Bringwellet, Werner Muller, who's older than me, a few years older than me, had gone to Tanzania with a Quaker group called actually escaping my name, but that's because I'm almost 80 years old and a lot of things are escaping my, a lot of names are going out of my mind now. Was a Quaker group volunteers, and we went, there were five different countries you could go to. And Werner had gone to Tanzania. And one point, when he, after he got back, he gave a slideshow of his work there. And I suddenly remembered that my grandmother had told me she had gone to China. She'd gone to India as a young girl as a teacher from Ireland. And then she had married my grandfather in England, and they had gone to China as missionaries. And my father was born in China, and they lived there 10 years, way up in Chengdu. And she had told me stories about this. And I thought, since I can't go home, and since I've kind of been to the South and done that, I need to get as far away as possible. And but I also, you know, I don't, since I don't need it, I don't have any skills, I'll just go and work for the, I'll see if I can get into this volunteer program. And what happened was that I applied late, and they always say, they took six people every year, and they had four, they want to take at least two women and the rest were men. So they had for that one summer, they had already accepted four men and one woman, but they had a slot open for another woman, and nobody that who applied, they didn't take. And I applied and I got it. So I'd also applied to the Peace Corps because I wanted to go to Nepal. I thought Nepal would be really beautiful. And so I got accepted to the Peace Corps for Nepal and to the American Parent Service Committee program, which was called VISA, that's right, Voluntary International Service Assignments. And so they had programs in Germany and India and Tanzania and Guatemala and the Southern Appalachians, because they felt like we need to work at home as long as we're working overseas. And it was a small program. There was only like 12 students in each group, and there were six each year that went out to these different countries. So there was only 24 students in each country. And it was all funded by the FSC. It was a volunteer thing. So I had to decide between Nepal and Tanzania, but I had to decide between the US government and the Quaker program. And I thought, I better, even though I wanted to go to Nepal more, I thought I better tuck myself into a Quaker program. And the other reason was that I knew that the Quakers lived alone in the villages and the Peace Corps volunteers lived in pairs. And I wanted to live alone. I felt like I'm not going to really get to know where I am unless I'm by myself. And so that's why I chose the Quaker program. And so we trained in Pendle Hill, all of us, all whatever, there were 30, but we six times five, yeah, 30 of us in Pendle Hill for the summer for a month. And we had language training there like 5 hours a day from previous volunteers who had trained us in Swahili. And then we went over, and I remember flying over there, like, I remember landing in Dar es Salaam and feeling like I'm home. It was just this amazing feeling, like, I really belong here. I moved here, and my dad was like, you know, freaked out. But I'm like, you don't want me home? I'm going, and there was no like phones or anything. It was only mail. in those days. He had no idea what was happening to me or where I was. So, yeah, I went to Tanzania. But what was your question?
I was asking you the result, basically, of being labeled an outside agitator, and you went in the direction that almost everyone else has gone in, which is to relate their school activist experiences to continued lifelong activism. Only one of you, I think, was not an overt activist. And that's because he was a journalist, which is a different kind of activism. So I'm just very pleased and happy that this is your experience, and you've given it to us. You've kind of affirmed that there really is a pathway that you all have tended to walk, regardless of where you were born or what your religion is, or you know, what you did for your careers. You've all kind of come either with a commitment to activist, socialist, human rights work, or you developed it while you were there and it carried you for the rest of your life. So I think that's marvelous.
Yeah. I don't see it as that was the turning point for me, because I was raised that way. Mm-hmm. You know, I was raised by a family who was activist by your definition, mm-hmm. from the get-go. They started this community, which was basically the most activist thing anybody could have possibly have done.
Very true.
So every single Saturday, first Saturday of every single month, the children were out there with the adults taking care of the land. Nobody was ever hired to take care of a common land. We built our own swimming pool. We built our own tennis courts. We built our own, you know, gas station. We had a little gas station there. I pumped gas there. You sign up for the gas. You know, it was like, we built each other's houses. You know, the kids worked on the roads. We tarred the roads every few years. We had the tar buggy. We got the brushes. You know, it is all basically your labor is what's going to build your life. Mm-hmm. And then you live with people and you commit to them, because yes, some people don't pull their load, too bad. You know, other people are going to pull their load for them. You know, this is life. You're not going to get rid of this family because they don't participate in the work party. You know, they said they would, they didn't, we move on. You know, I remember discussions about this family who wouldn't participate. My parents were, look at us, we'll pick up that load. We can pick up that load. So they really put their money where their mouth is, and it wasn't easy what they did. It was really, really hard. And, you know, the community's gone through ups and downs, and sometimes it's looked like it's not going to make it because all the houses are owned by the individual, but all the land is common. So you have to sell your house to a member, and sometimes you can't get members because it's like, who wants to like be part of a community and work on it? But now what they've done is they've managed to sell it to people who want to be there. It's come around full circle. Because for a while there was everybody wanted their own little this and their own little that and then now people see like that's stupid. Who you don't get if you have your own little this and your own little that, what you're losing is more than what you're getting.
Yes.
So now they've been able to find families who have been looking for something like this and who are bringing this new energy and this new vital health and this new like, I can't believe I'm in the community where this is what's important and they've done it for me. I don't have to build it. The roads are done. The lots are done. The houses are done. And I get to live here in this beautiful place and take care of it and be part of this community. And so now there's a whole new, like, and we are old enough. We've lived long enough to appreciate it and enjoy it. And, you know, our parents are gone. And it's like, so now we've inherited this amazing thing.
Yeah. Now you're the parents, the elders. It's you now that, you know, you get to solidify and pass along to the next generation. And how wonderful, like, I think it was Gavin Wright I was talking to, who's very excited about youth activism around climate change. And so his circle that I'm about to ask you about your circle, his circle is to see student groups regenerate the way you all were student activists. Now, the student activism is very solidly and vocally around climate change. So I wonder, as we call our comments to a close, now that you look back and you have this huge perspective of where you've been and what you did, whether you tried to do it or not, the effect of your work, and now you look at where we are today, how do you feel about that? What do you feel that there's some spot where the train ran off the track, or the effort became circular instead of straightforward to progress? What do you feel about any of that?
Well, see, I'm very, very fortunate because I was married twice. My first marriage didn't work out. And so I met my second husband when I was 38. We had a daughter when I was 39 and daughter when I was 41. And both of my daughters are CEOs mm-hmm. of companies that they have founded. And my older daughter is CEO of a doula company. She provides birth support for babies. And she has she was employed by a set of four hospitals in Seattle to provide doula services. And she contracts with them, and she hired 90 doulas, and they are now been integrated into the staff of the hospital. There's three shifts of 8-hour shifts. So there's always two doulas. I mean, it's a whole brand new vision that she has, that she implemented, of taking care of the doulas, taking care of the moms and the babies and the families. And she's got a bereavement program for families who've lost their babies. And she's got a Black birth program for Black people who want a Black doula and that culture. I mean, she has two kids of her own. She's married, she lives in Seattle. So, you know, she's kind of the proof of the pudding. And my younger daughter is the CEO of a company called Elemental Accelerator. And for the last 10 years, she's been funding renewable energy technologies for climate. Mm-hmm. And now she's got 110 companies that she's funded, and she's started a separate fund now. And I'm traveling with her beginning on Monday for a week so that I can help her take care of her baby while she's in these meetings. She has another office in Palo Alto, in East Palo Alto. And her vision is to connect renewable energy technologies, which is what she's funded. These 110 companies are all different renewable technologies in water and soil and energy conservation and food, transportation. Those are the five sectors that she funds, and none of them compete, because her idea is that all these CEOs come together once a year, and they share information. And what she does is she finds out from them what they need, and then she hires consultants who will give them whatever it is. Marketing or economic or personnel or management, whatever it is they need, and they all share. So she's basically taken Bringuella concept and she's put it into climate change. And she's masterful at raising money. She loves raising money. And so she loves spending money. And she has this wonderful staff now, 25 people that just, you know, they are way, way out in front. And what she's now recently done, and she gave a TED talk about this last fall in Scotland at a big conference, is what she's doing now. She's funding the community part of it. She says, because we don't fund the community. We have the technologies and we have the policy, which she's also very, very involved in policy, because she says without technology and policy, we can't get anything implemented. But now she says, we failed to get the community involved. So now what she does is she finds communities of people who need something, like they want to clean up a lake or something. And she pays the community group of it, the volunteer group or whatever group it is. That's part of her funding. She will fund that. And she says, we have to do this across the board with all the energy technologies that we're doing. We have to connect to the community, find out what they want, and then make the technologies that fit, mm-hmm. put them all together with the policy. And it's got to be these three things or else we cannot see what's happening in the climate. So that's her vision. And I think that the heritage of my activism and my rootedness in community and And you don't know this about me, but I'm a professional storyteller. So I had my own business and I taught storytelling. I taught through storytelling first to children, then to high school students, then to college students, and then to graduate students. And my own children perform with me. And I paid them. If we performed together, I gave them half of my fee, or if they both came, I gave them each got a third of my fee. So they're, and they say that like the training in connecting to an audience and performing before large groups of children in schools, and they've given workshops to teachers as high school students. They would go to conferences and offer workshops. And if I can tell stories, so can you, and teaching the students, teaching the teachers themselves. So I think that's kind of there. That's kind of the way I see my legacy.
Mm-hmm. I see it too.
whatever there is my legacy.
Oh no, you've got a big one. Very modest. You all are all very, very modest and very powerful. And
I'm also involved in my community. So what I've been doing for the past 7-8 years, where I live in Mercer Island, well, for 10 years, I guess, is that they tried to destroy our library. That the regional library tried to come in and put this huge glass meeting room inside our library, which we didn't want. So it took us 2 or 3 years to fight that, and we finally won, which was impossible to win against this big regional library system that decided they're going to redo our library. But we protected our library, and then the group had to morph and protect our central town center park from a big art center, which was the artists fighting against the parks people. But we managed against huge odds, because it had already been voted on by the city council and everything, to protect our park. We got rid of the art center in the park, even, and they said, this is the arts. I'm like, but I'm an artist, I'm a storyteller, you know, but you don't put an art center in our park. That's it. And then we had to protect it against a thrift shop. So, I mean, it's like, it's still community organizing, but on a very local level.
For me, though,
I realized like the reason I want to protect the park is because I grew up in Green Dwelling with common land. Mm-hmm. And I know that common land healed me. Mm-hmm. And so we live on an island, Mercer Island. Our house is still there. We don't live there right now. We live in Hawaii because my daughter needs us for childcare, which of course I love. It's my dessert of my life. I have to take care of an infant and a 3-year-old and whew, lucky.
I want to thank you for your wonderful conversation today. And those fabulous writings you all have been given to the library to archive, but I certainly would love it if you guys put together a book, because you certainly should, to have that many letters. It's just thrilling. It's a beautiful thing. And I think you should publish them.
Really?
Yes.
How do you envision that? I'm really interested in that. How would that happen?
With an introductory chapter to give me basic setting, background, characters, and launch forth into a conversation, a back and forth between you two. Now, you may have to fictionalize a bit here and there if you need to fill in, but that's absolutely, that would just be a beautiful book. I just think it would be a fabulous book. Call me if you need a ghostwriter.
No, I'm serious. I mean, this is so interesting because, you know, you're talking about fictionalization. No, we don't talk about it that way because it's the story. Everything is true in the story except the story itself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the way we think of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever is fictional in that, you know, is part of the story, becomes part of the story. But
it's hard. It's nearly impossible to say. Fiction is kind of a fallacy, actually, because while some author may put together a series of content that is unrelated to anything that you can put your finger on, it's still the author speaking to you. It's the author's creation. It's their art.
Right.
And so right. It's never fiction. It's real to them.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, that's right. On that note, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have a wonderful, I'm going to send you a thank you and a next steps for this. And I hope to speak with you again soon. If you got any questions or you think of anything else wonderful, feel free to reach out.
Thanks very much. You too.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure and fun to talk to you. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
I'm happy to have had this conversation. I'm glad we made it, even though Zoom tried to be mean to us.
Yeah, we're persistent. Both of us are persistent. That's why we got where we are, right?
Yes, ma'am.
We're stubborn. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.